WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today, Secretary of State James Baker continued his post-war diplomacy in the Middle East. In these first few weeks after the war, we don't yet know how the Middle East will be politically changed. We invited Joe Stork to talk with us about the political aftermath of the war in the Gulf. Stork is the co-founder of the Middle East Research and Information Project in Washington, D.C., and editor-in-chief of the bi-monthly magazine Middle East Report.
The political aftermath of this war is something that's going to be measured over the next several years, and not just over the next several weeks. I see this as a political trauma for the region that's very much on a scale, dimensions of the 1948-49 first Israel-Arab state war, the 1967 war between Israel and the Arab states. In both of those cases, for instance, it really wasn't until 2, 3, 4 years later that you really saw the political repercussions in terms of regime changes and so forth.
Some of the Arab countries have more power now than they did before.
Sure.
The Saudis, for instance, came out really on top in this war. Yeah. How do you think they're going to use their new power in the Middle East?
I think one thing you may see, the Saudis, who in the past behaved extremely cautiously, very much as the balancer, never getting very far out ahead of the Arab state political consensus. With this decision to bring in American troops and then all the subsequent decisions that followed from that, the Saudis have really sort of stepped out in front, so to speak. And there is a segment of the ruling family which has been very much promoting that. And I see that being somewhat understandable on generational lines. It's the younger generation, people like Prince Bandar, the Saudi ambassador to the U.S., who's the son of the defense minister, and others of his generation who've been very much pushing this, what I call a pro-American and very sort of no-holds-barred, let's-get-out-in-front kind of line. Now, this is not something that, it's not characteristic of Saudi political behavior in the past. I'm not sure how comfortable the Bandar's father and his uncles, such as the king, really are with this policy and with what the consequences may be. I think, you know, a number of things are going on in the region right now. There's all of the pressures that have developed, really intensified in Kuwait, for instance, for some sort of democratic regime, some kind of presence of a democratic opposition. The very same thing hopefully will develop out of the turmoil in Iraq. At the other end of the Arabian Peninsula, in Yemen, there you have North Yemen and South Yemen had a peaceful political reunification back in May 1990. The result has been an explosion, really, of democratic, popular, political activity, a real liberalization, a real opening up, which is something the Saudis of either generation, but including the youngsters like Bandar, are not at all interested in seeing. So
why not?
Well, their position, their preserve, depends on the kind of autocratic, virtually dictatorial rule that they've enjoyed for the last 50, 60 years. I mean, they don't want to see that disturbed. The reason the Kuwaitis abolished their parliament in 1986, I mean, there were several reasons. It's true. For one thing, some of the parliamentarians started to ask questions about some financial scandals that the emir and his family were involved in. But one of the reasons came from outside of Kuwait, and it was pressure from the Saudis. They're not interested in democratic experiment on the Arabian Peninsula. And what they see happening, and I think it's something that would have happened with or without this war, but because of the war, it's sort of erupting rather than just sort of evolving. They're seeing this happen at both ends, at the southwestern end in the case of Yemen, and at the northeastern end in the case of Kuwait, for sure, and quite possibly Iraq. And of course, the Saudi game in Iraq is going to be very interesting to watch. I mean, you can bet that as we speak, they're shoveling lots of guns and money to their people. in an effort to make sure that what ends up in the post Saddam shakedown is a regime that won't be too liberal or democratic.
Let me ask you about Syria. Now, Syria's position in the Middle East, I think, was strengthened as a result of the war. Its ties to the United States were strengthened as a result of the war. What direction do you think Hafez al-Assad wants to see politics heading in the Middle East now? How do you think he would like to restructure things?
Well, I think, first let me make a general observation that I think actually what you've seen strengthened more than this state or that state is the state in general in the region, with the main exception being Kuwait. But I think, for instance, in terms of those Arab states or those states that allied themselves with the United States, in every case we're talking about a strengthening of the regime vis-a-vis society. This was not a popular move in Syria, not at all. In Egypt, at least, there was at least a passive support for the Mubarak decision to go along with the allies. In Syria, this was not the case. So I would say that's one case to watch and see just how strong Hafez al-Assad ends up being as a result of this. This was not a popular move. It helps, of course, that he came up smelling like roses, that the defeat of the Iraqis was so swift and apparently painless for Syrian troops. Assad was trying to position himself, actually. You can look back even before this crisis began and see this happening as a result of the decline of the Soviet role in the region. Syria had depended quite heavily on Soviet military aid, economic support, treaties of friendship and cooperation, and the rest of the package that usually goes along with relations with Moscow. All of that was on the decline. Syria was looking, the regime was already looking to reposition itself. It had renewed diplomatic relations with Egypt in the summer, actually a few months before the crisis started, back in the spring. There had been the first visits between the Syrian and Egyptian leaders since before the Camp David agreement. So this kind of repositioning had already been going on. And of course, this locks it in. And in a period of growing economic crisis affecting the region as a whole, the Syrians and the Egyptian state, at least, are relatively well poised to, if not gain, at least not be too badly hurt by what I see as a continuing process of intensification of economic crisis in the region, because they will be essentially renting themselves out as security forces in the Gulf and being paid handsome subventions by the Saudis, the Kuwaiti prince, and the other small ruling families of the Gulf.
A lot of people say that Hafez al-Assad is as tyrannical as Saddam Hussein. Do you think that he will become the next Saddam Hussein in the Middle East?
Well, or was he the past Saddam Hussein of the Middle East? You know, I think one of the unfortunate things about this crisis and the way it's been played here in the United States is this tendency to what I'd call Nintendo politics. You know, today's monster, we have to go in and defeat him. Then Mario, a.k.a. George Bush, takes care of Saddam Hussein, who's tomorrow's monster, or who's yesterday's monster. You know, it was Khomeini, or before that his name was Gaddafi. This sort of approach of it's really extremely short-sighted, and it's extremely I think it's extremely harmful to our own democratic values, but it's certainly extremely harmful to democratic possibilities in the region. So in a way, I don't like the question much. Hafez al-Assad's regime certainly is tyrannical enough. I think at the same time, it has to be said that no ruling clique ever in the region did manage to achieve the same degree of virtually totalitarian control over society that Saddam Hussein did in Iraq. Not because Hafez al-Assad is a better person, but it's just the various social forces at work in the country, the relative strength of the regime vis-a-vis those forces, he just wasn't able to achieve that same degree of control, and I don't think he will be either. So in that sense, Syria is going to remain. It's not going to be another Iraq.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joe Storck, and he's the co-founder of the Middle East Research and Information Project and editor-in-chief of the Middle East Report, which is a bi-monthly magazine. Now, I know you opposed the war. Would you like to see any of the countries who were involved with the war going into Iraq to try to help the people who are being put down by Saddam's forces?
My general view of this is that these kinds of interventions are counterproductive. I do think that this instance, though, in this instance, you're talking about a situation where I would certainly like to see some way that the Saddam's guns could be quieted and could be silenced. I'm not sure, though, which outside force represents a realistic and politically healthy one to encourage to go in, quite frankly. So I think I would come down saying no. It's something that has to be played out between amongst Iraqis, essentially. I feel there's a certain amount of appeal to the idea that the U.S., for instance, might move in to prevent the Iraqi forces from using poison gas. But again, it's a good question. It's a difficult question to answer. I think in the end, that the political future of Iraq is something that is in the hands of the Iraqi people now, that the regime's capacity to put down the rebellions to the extent that they're happening, it seems, virtually all over the country, is a pretty limited one. And, of course, I'm all for preventing the regime, preventing the Iraqi army from securing the wherewithal to continue that fight. But given the interests of the various possible interveners, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, the U.S., etc., I'm not sure it's a very healthy thing to be encouraging or wanting to see any of them get involved any further.
Do you think that the uprisings in Iraq now are a positive outcome of the war?
I think they can be. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think the break in Saddam's hold over the Iraqi people and the break in his military hegemony, the hegemony of his security forces, is a positive thing. I don't think it's an excuse for the war. I don't think it's why the war was fought by the U.S. and its allies. There are a number of positive developments, I think, coming out of this. I think, to go back to a point I made earlier, the tensions that have erupted in Kuwait and this what appears to be the obvious strengthening of those elements in Kuwaiti society who want a more democratic polity coming out of this. I think that's positive. That shouldn't be understood as some sort of endorsement of the war. But I do think it is one of the positive developments, and it's the kind of development that, in fact, peace and justice forces in the United States should be encouraging. I don't think it's one that the United States government is going to be particularly encouraging.
James Baker is in Israel today. Are you encouraged about Arab-Israeli peace and Israeli-Palestinian reconciliation? And do you think James Baker's visit and George Bush's plan will help?
I don't know what George Bush's plan is, quite frankly. Uh-huh. It has not been revealed to the likes of us, if there is one. I'd say let's wait and see. I'll believe it when I see it. This reminds me very much of the kind of wheel spinning and diplomatic charade that we've seen time and time again. Remember after the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, we had the famous Reagan plan. Go back before that. At every point of crisis, the United States has stepped in, sending a Secretary of State or major political emissary over with this kind of talk.
Well, Joe Storck, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Joe Storck is the editor-in-chief of the bi-monthly Middle East Report. This is Fresh Air.